At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
What happens when the world's second largest economy slows down? Why are news outlets sending so much business to Amazon? And zoning is way more fascinating than you might think. I promise. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. From the studios of Colorado Public Radio in Denver today, I'm Amy Scott in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, the 15th of July. Good to have you with us. We're going to start today with China, where the economy has been growing quarter after quarter, year after year for decades. And today's news that GDP grew 6.2% in the last quarter was more of the same, except that it was the slowest growth in nearly 30 years. Chinese consumers haven't been buying the way they used to, and that's being felt around the global economy. Marketplace's Scott Tong gets us started with a look at one example, the market for cars.
For decades, global companies have bet on China's 1 billion consumers as their next great market. But now growth has slowed. And Shahzad Kazi of China Beige Book International says China's transition from a factory-based economy to a consumer economy has disappointed.
2 years ago, everybody talked about the new economy taking over and how that was the future and that's where growth and employment, et cetera, were going to come from. And that just has absolutely not panned out. The old economy, the industry-heavy sectors remain absolutely critical to Chinese economic growth.
Consumer confidence is wobbly in sectors like auto sales, which have slumped for 12 straight months, says transportation analyst Michael Dunn. His book is American Wheels, Chinese Roads.
When the Chinese consumer is confident, there's no end to their ambition to buy the next new bling. But when things turn south, Chinese consumers can get very conservative in a hurry.
Once, German auto brands made 40% of their profits from China, and General Motors booked $2 billion in profits every year, Dunn says. Now, not only are Chinese buying fewer cars, they're taking the mainland version of Uber more.
For the savvy urban dweller, the new cool is to make use of increasingly convenient, clean, and safe on-demand services.
All of this makes the China market more complicated for global companies. It's getting harder as the pie expands more slowly, says Trey McCarver at the research firm Trivium China.
For a long time, if you were a foreign company, it really didn't matter what you were doing. Whatever you were doing was growing, and it was growing very quickly in China. It's a different story today.
He is quick to say that China remains a giant market for phones, home buyers, international tourists. It's just maturing. So some areas, like car sales, are getting saturated. I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
You've probably gathered by now that it's Amazon Prime Day. And if you're like me, your social media and email are probably stuffed with recommendations from every blogger and media outlet on the planet telling you how to make the most of the monster 2-day sale. You'd think they were getting paid or something. And actually, they probably are. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson has that one.
Do you want some help finding the best deals on laptops, on beauty products, on stuff for your pets? There are guides online to help you find all those and more. If you click those links to make a purchase, Amazon, just like other online retailers, will pay a small commission to the recommender, which might be a social media influencer or a media outlet like USA Today or Wired. It's known as affiliate marketing, and those little clicks can add up to big sales. Sucharita Kadali is a retail analyst with Forrester. She says it's one of retailers' top online marketing strategies.
The most important thing is like email. The second most important thing is Google. The third most important thing these days is Facebook. And then right after that is usually affiliates.
It's never been easier to become an affiliate, says Price Glomsky with the digital marketing agency PMG. But he says it's also never been more challenging to make money as an affiliate.
And there tend to be, you know, like the top 10 or 15 that drive most of the volume, but there are hundreds of thousands of them within the marketplace.
He says affiliates earn commissions that are typically between 3 and 7%. It's not a new phenomenon, but Michael Schwart, a researcher at Princeton who studies affiliate marketing, says nobody really knows how widespread it is.
One of the big research questions that we've had this whole time is, how often does this actually happen? And so estimates are kind of all over the place and nobody really knows.
His research has focused on links in YouTube videos. He says it could be that one out of every 100 has an affiliate link, or it might be higher, like one in 20. But he says only 10% of videos with links also include disclosures. So most people who click don't realize the recommender could benefit from their purchase. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
Corporate earnings season kicked off today. Try to contain your excitement. We'll have details when we do the numbers. When you visualize the American dream, chances are there's a house in there somewhere, most likely a detached single-family house. In a lot of neighborhoods, that's all developers are allowed to build because of zoning regulations. But that's starting to change as cities nationwide grapple with a housing shortage and the history of racial and class segregation. The state of Oregon just banned single-family zoning in much of the state. Emily Badger wrote about these developments for the New York Times and joins us now. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Amy. It's great to be here.
So you describe single-family zoning as practically gospel in America, but it hasn't always been that way. How did that come to be?
So zoning is this concept that really started to spread all across the country starting in the 1920s, which is when the Supreme Court said it's totally kosher for local communities to try to do this. And, you know, part of what zoning said was you can put your commercial land over here and your residential land over there. But the other idea that a lot of communities really embraced was sort of separating the residential land so that neighborhoods over here have only single family homes in them. And we see in lots of cities across the country, 85% of the residential land is devoted to this one idea, which basically means it's illegal to build anything other than a single family home in that much of the land.
And the maps in your piece are really striking in cities like San Jose, California, Charlotte, North Carolina, Arlington, Texas. You have these seas of pink representing single family zoning with these tiny little pockets of green where more density is allowed. What has been the effect of all that pink?
There are a bunch of issues that are all bound up in zoning, many of which are coming to a head right now. So in one sense, there's this problem where vast single-family housing and single-family zoning has contributed to housing shortages, has made it really difficult and expensive to build more housing in these cities. Another concern that a lot of people have about single-family zoning is that, you know, if you can't build enough housing in these cities, it's going to contribute to sprawl. It's going to push development further out. There's also a lot of racial inequity and racial injustice that have historically been baked into the idea of single-family zoning, even if that's not the intention of zoning laws in the 21st century.
And now you're seeing what seems to be a growing movement to undo some of that history, to allow more density. Talk about what recently happened in the city of Minneapolis.
So Minneapolis, in December, the city council there voted to end single-family zoning across the entire city. And what Minneapolis was saying was, you know, we are going to overnight change how 70% of our residential land is classified and what's possible to build there. Once Minneapolis did this crazy thing, other cities started to call Minneapolis and say, how did you do this? How did you talk to the public about this? Places like Portland, Charlotte, Austin, they're also starting to have these conversations. And, you know, to have an entire state in Oregon say, we're fundamentally going to rethink this too, up the ante even further beyond what Minneapolis had done.
Is the opposition to these changes just basically NIMBYism, you know, not in my backyard, which, as you pointed out, is often tinged with racism and classism? Or are there some legitimate concerns, you know, things like traffic, congestion? You mentioned sewer capacity in your story.
Yeah, I mean, there are absolutely legitimate concerns that people have about what kind of change is going to be unleashed by this. You know, I don't know what's going to happen in my neighborhood. I don't know what's going to happen to my property value. I don't know if, you know, the local school system can accommodate more families in this neighborhood. And on the other hand, we have people making much more kind of global arguments about, you know, is this system that we've built going to promote, you know, the climate change goals that we have? As a community? Is it promoting economic equality? And there's a lot of tension between those two sets of arguments.
More density is supposed to create more affordable housing, but what's to stop developers from just building more luxury townhouses or duplexes on the lots that used to have single family homes?
So there are two different sort of strategies at play here. One strategy says, you know, let's try to make the market work better. Let's create more supply so that the cost of housing comes down. But the other strategy has to be this more intentional public policy choice that says we're going to mandate that some of this new housing that gets built with this added capacity actually is being offered to people who cannot afford to pay market rate.
Emily Badger wrote about the actually fascinating topic of zoning for the New York Times. Emily, thanks.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
In today's installment of Robots Are Taking Over the World, artificial intelligence recently reached a new milestone. Scientists at Carnegie Mellon developed a program that can beat humans at six-player poker. These algorithms aren't the kind we're getting familiar with, the ones that recommend movies and music you might like or set prices for airline seats. This new program is about strategy. And as Marketplace's Sabri Benishor reports, it could find its way into business, politics, even war.
For really good poker players, playing well involves looking for weaknesses in their opponents.
And then attacking those areas, exploiting them for all the money you can.
Jason Less is a professional poker player, and he, along with four other pros, went up against an artificial intelligence program named Pluribus in six-player Texas Hold'em played on a computer.
This AI did not have any of those weaknesses.
Things did not go well for Team Humanity. Jason and all the other humans lost repeatedly. And yes, the computer bluffed. It lied and lied just like a human.
The AI did bluff. The AI was a very efficient bluffer, which made it very difficult to play against.
Our AI makes superhuman strategic reasoning decisions.
Thomas Sandholm is part of the team who created Pluribus. He's professor of computer science at Carnegie Mellon. Poker is different from chess or checkers because in those games, you can see the board. You can see your opponent's pieces. You see the world you're in. In poker, you can't. You don't know what cards your opponents have or what their strategy might be.
This is an important characteristic of any real-world strategic situation, which is why poker is sometimes used for training and negotiation and trading in financial markets, for example.
Michael Wellman is professor of computer science and engineering at the University of Michigan. Sandholm's poker algorithms map out all the possible strategies of all the different players in the game and how those might interact.
So translating this to practical application is not necessarily trivial or right around the corner, but I think that demonstrations in these games show the way.
Sandholm, who helped create Pluribus, has actually started two companies, Strategic Machine and Strategy Robot, to apply his algorithms to the real world.
Think about political candidates deciding how much to spend in each state.
One candidate's strategy might depend on what another candidate does. Similar problems exist in business, how to pick which cars to produce, how to price products. What you do can affect what your competitors do, which can affect what you do.
Different companies can actually think ahead how their pricing moves will affect their competitors' pricing moves.
Sandholm says his other company, Strategy Robot, plans to offer their superhuman strategic reasoning programs to the government, including to the military. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishor for Marketplace.
Algorithms aside, poker is still a human game. Our latest episode of This Is Uncomfortable takes you inside that world with a former card counter. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Coming up,
You're listening to the site, you're listening to the different links and the different words, and you're creating a mental picture.
Web design for the visually impaired. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced 27 points, 0.1%, to close at 27,359, a record high. Ditto for the NASDAQ. It put on 14 points, nearly 0.2%, to finish at 8,258. The S&P 500 gained just half a point, basically flat, to end at 3014. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin made strong comments about Facebook's new cryptocurrency, Libra, calling it a national security issue and a potential tool for money launderers. This comes just a day before the tech giant is set to appear before the Senate Banking Committee to answer questions about Libra. Shares of Facebook slipped 0.5%. Citigroup kicked off a big week for earnings reports. The bank beat estimates for second quarter earnings. Profits hit $4.8 billion, better than a year ago. But interest margins declined. Citigroup shares lost nearly 0.1%. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 2.09%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. It's no secret that some of the places in the country with the most economic opportunity, like Silicon Valley, New York, D.C., are also some of the most expensive places to live. But now that may be convincing a certain kind of worker, members of the so-called creative class, to consider living in other parts of the country. Richard Florida is author of the 2002 book, The Rise of the Creative Class, and published some new research about this demographic at CityLab. It's good to have you back on the show.
Oh, thanks for having me back.
So first, a definition. What do you mean when you talk about the creative class?
Well, this is something I identified nearly 20 years ago. And really what I was trying to figure out was the people who drive our new innovation knowledge economy. So that's people who work in science and technology, who do research, who are entrepreneurs, but also artists, designers, musicians, and cultural creatives. Add them all up, and it's more than a third of our workforce, and probably in excess of 40 million Americans work in these jobs.
We tend to think of these workers, these creative class workers, as clustered in the big, expensive cities, you know, mostly on the coasts. But you decided to look at what you call the geography of talent. What did you find?
Well, I think it is true that the creative class, per se, is massively concentrated in the coastal superstar cities and tech hubs. But you also see big clusters in Baltimore and Philadelphia. And then finally, I think, which was kind of the most eye-opening thing for me when I looked at the new geography of the creative class, is the surge in the creative class in places like Pittsburgh, Salt Lake City, St. Louis. In fact, when I looked at the top 10 fastest-growing creative class centers, only one established high-tech metro, Seattle, made that group. I think that's a change that I didn't expect and was kind of a good news, I think.
What do you think's going on there? Are these cities just doing a better job of attracting these workers, or is part of the story that people are just getting priced out of the sort of superstar cities?
I think both things are going on. You know, Cincinnati, Detroit have made a great effort to make themselves more appealing to talent, but also, as you accurately say, it's a heck of a expensive proposition to try to make a go of it as a young person in San Francisco. And it's no longer a gaping difference, you know, between the quality of life or amenities. You know, Pittsburgh or Detroit or Cincinnati or Cleveland offer you pretty much a similar bucket of lifestyle amenities that you would get in one of the expensive places. So I think it makes sense for people to say, the heck with this, I'm going to one of these other so-called rise of the rest places.
But with that rise, do these cities then start to experience some of the problems we've seen in San Francisco and Boston and here in Denver, with, you know, increased inequality, gentrification, the things that have come along with the rise of the creative class?
Yes, 100%. What I think, though, is in places like Philadelphia or Denver, you have the opportunity to learn from what has happened in San Francisco and plan to become more affordable or to provide more housing, to cope a little bit better with inequality.
It's been almost 20 years since your book, The Rise of the Creative Class, came out, which encouraged cities to attract these creative class workers. And you've received some criticism for that, for allegedly fueling gentrification and inequality. How has your own thinking changed
since then.
I think I certainly underestimated the velocity and ferocity of this change, which really kicks into high gear, you know, after 2010, and we begin to see this kind of hyper-gentrification. This divide, if you will, is getting worse. So I think it's time that we as cities and as a country begin to become more vigilant in both recognizing this and working to counter it. One last thing that I think is very important to point out. People see this data and sometimes say, well, every city is doing better. You know, if there were a half dozen or a dozen original tech hubs, there's now another dozen places that are beginning to improve their status, but that still means there's hundreds of U.S. small and medium-sized metros that are suffering and that we need to take seriously.
Richard Florida, co-founder and editor-at-large for CityLab, also a professor at the University of Toronto. Thank you so much.
I very much appreciate it.
If you've ever created a website or just used one, really, you know there's a lot that goes into making a good website. How does it look? Is it mobile friendly? Is it easy to make a purchase or find contact information? All those concerns typically assume the user is a sighted person, as in they can see your website. But now more businesses are paying attention to accessibility for the visually impaired because they have to. Miles Bryan reports.
David Middleton spends his workdays listening to websites.
So we'll go to the top of the site.
Search button, article, floor plan, heading level 1, no need to sacrifice space or location, clickable studio 1.
That's the readout of a website for an apartment rental agency. While it might sound fast to sighted people, Middleton says that's the speed many users who are visually impaired prefer.
You're listening to the site, you're listening to the different links and the different words, and you're creating a mental picture of that site.
Middleton's one of the founders of Accessibility Shield, a startup based in the Philly suburbs that works with businesses and web developers to make sure their sites are accessible to people with visual impairments. Accessibility Shield has only been around since March, but it already has 10 full-time employees and is working with close to 1,000 clients. The company says most of those clients are motivated by concern about being sued over the Americans with Disabilities Act. The number of federal website accessibility lawsuits nationwide has been growing significantly, from about 800 in 2017 to more than 2,200 last year, according to the law firm Seyfarth Shaw. Min Vu is a partner at the firm, which defends businesses in these cases.
This is a very difficult issue for businesses because this issue of accessibility has just not been around that long.
One big problem is a lack of clear standards for exactly how businesses are supposed to adhere to the ADA. Vu says almost all courts have ruled that businesses with a physical presence can be held liable under the ADA for their websites. But businesses seeking guidance on how exactly to comply have to look to a shifting patchwork of legal rulings. Back in 2010, the Department of Justice announced it was going to release specific nationwide guidelines. But in 2017, the DOJ abandoned that effort, saying it would evaluate whether new rules are, quote, necessary and appropriate.
There should have been a set of regulations with an orderly process that businesses could understand and follow. We got none of that.
Benjamin Sweet, an attorney who specializes in bringing accessibility lawsuits on behalf of clients with disabilities, also wants the feds to offer clear guidance. But he says for now, litigation is the best tool for making the web accessible to his clients.
I send a demand letter to a business on behalf of one of my clients. There's no requirement that they respond to it or engage with us. In contrast, if I file a lawsuit, then they're confronted with having to make real changes.
John McInerney wants more websites to make those changes. He's the head of the Pennsylvania Association for the Blind and says it's a daily challenge for him and other people with visual impairments to navigate in a world where everything from paying the utility bill to applying for a job happens online.
It's very frustrating to complete some of those employment applications, particularly when a graphic pops up to do something.
Still, McInerney says he's happy that more people are paying attention to issues that people who can't read a website face.
The more we increase visibility, the more people who are developing internet applications, I think, will be sensitive to that.
The Supreme Court is currently considering whether to take a case brought by a man who's blind against the pizza chain Domino's for not making its website and mobile app accessible to him. Among other things, his lawsuit claims he couldn't take advantage of the pizza company's online-only discounts. In Philadelphia, I'm Miles Bryan for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out about the 50-pound British banknote, which will soon have a new face, Alan Turing, the late mathematician and codebreaker known as the father of computer science and artificial intelligence. The Bank of England announced the choice today for the last of its paper notes to be replaced by a thin plastic, considered to be stronger and harder to counterfeit. There was some question, by the way, about whether there would even continue to be a 50-pound note. It's the least used denomination in Britain and described by some as the currency of criminals and corrupt elites. I have to say, someone paid me with a $50 U.S. bill this weekend at a garage sale, and I was like, what is this? Anyway, congrats, Mr. Turing. Very cool. All right, we've got to go. The Dow Jones Industrial Average advanced 27 points, 0.1%. The NASDAQ put on 14 points, nearly 0.2%. And the S&P 500 gained just a half a point, basically flat. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, Daisy Palacios, and Daniel Shin. Our special projects desk includes Tommy Andres and Eliza Mills. And I'm Amy Scott. Meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.